This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Over the Memorial Day weekend, we heard lots of praise for our military service members and the sacrifices they've made. But for our guest today, historian James Wright, these laudatory speeches have a superficial ring. The truth is, he says, most Americans are highly disconnected from those who fight our battles. Despite all the talk about our sons and daughters who go off to war, he says, the children of 99% of us are safely at home. And that disconnect extends to our politics, too. Wright says the percentage of veterans serving in Congress is lower than it's been in 70 years, only 20% compared to 50% as recently as 1990. Now in a new book called Those Who Have Borne the Battle, Wright explores how this modern separation between military and non-military Americans shapes attitudes and policies toward war and those who serve. He also looks at how our approach toward veterans has fluctuated over time, from the citizen soldier of the Revolutionary War to our current volunteer professional forces. Today in The Exchange, James Wright is here, and we'll cover some of the themes he examines in his new book, Those Who Have Borne the Battle, A History of America's Wars and Those Who Fought Them. Let's hear from you. If you've served in the military or are a member of a military family, do you feel this gap? How do you see it shaping public policy or the attitudes of your neighbors? And even if you don't have a military background, how have you seen public attitudes toward wars and those who fight them change over time? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And Professor Wright, it's really nice to see you. Welcome back to The Exchange.
Thank you, Laura. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, let's tackle this idea, if we could, of a disconnect, Professor Wright. How is the relationship between military and non-military people in America different than it used to be?
I think there's a tremendous warm feeling toward the military, a tremendous sense of pride toward those who are serving in the military. You mentioned a disconnect, and there is that in terms of emotions, but I think Americans are very proud of the military. It's just that most people in this country don't know anyone who's in the military today. They don't know what it is that we're asking them to do, and so that's my point. It's not that we're suddenly don't care about them. There are outpourings of enthusiasm. Surely yesterday there were.
So it's not an animosity or a suspicion. It's more just we don't really get what they do and what they go through.
No, I think that the military probably ranks highest among most American institutions today in terms of public confidence in them. I think that that's been true for 15, 20 years. Obviously, that was not true 35, 40 years ago at the end of the Vietnam War.
And there's a regional disconnect too, right, Professor Wright? I mean, we feel it more in the Northeast than perhaps in the Midwest or South.
We have a connection in New Hampshire. It's certainly regionally the South and the West provide the bulk of those who are serving in the military today. Absolutely, they tend to be rural more than urban. But northern New England states, Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire, have really sent a fair number of young people to serve during the war. During the wars, I should say. We've taken heavy casualties. A few years ago, Vermont had the highest casualties of any American state as a proportion of that state's population.
So what's that disconnect all about? What causes it?
I think that the military is much smaller today than it's ever been, and there is no draft. We depend upon volunteers, and in many communities in this country, there's no longer any sense of a tradition of volunteering. I think I've been unable to get good data from the Pentagon on this, but clearly there's a generational thing. Many people who join the military today have fathers or older brothers or older sisters even who have been in the military.
And here's a question I think, Professor Wright, that gets the heart of your book. You know, why does this disconnect matter? I mean, you could argue that in a country with a volunteer force, you know, those who want to follow a military career do so. Those who don't want to follow a military career don't. They pick a different path. So why does this even matter?
I think when we went to the all-volunteer force, this was a very important part of the rationale for that, almost a libertarian view that was widely shared in the early 1970s, that let those who want to serve, serve. Let's not drag in others who prefer not to be there.
And yeah, I think so that, what's wrong with that?
Well, the question was, can we maintain the size of the force we need? And we have done that. The military today is stronger, more professional, better educated, really, than it's ever been in American history. What's wrong with it, I think, is when we send these forces off to war, most of us have no personal knowledge of what it is that we're asking them to do. We don't have good coverage from the war zones. There's nothing very exciting happening there. Most news organizations have had to cut back on their correspondence, so we're missing that today. And we don't have the personal touch. It's almost a video game war fought by drones and by people wearing all of this armor that we don't recognize them. And I think that war, including the wars we're in today, is in many ways the most human experience there can be. It's cruel. It's nasty. It's bitter. I'm not speaking positively of the experience. But there's nothing finally more human than asking somebody to go to war. And we need to understand better what it is that we're asking them to do. I point out in the book that we raise our children and really instill in them two fundamental principles. I hope more than two, but one has to do with keeping themselves away from harm. We as soon as
don't
they're able
the
to
street.
Hear, don't play right. in the street, don't touch something hot, don't do this, don't do that. And secondly, not to harm others. Then at age 18 or 19, they join the military and they're asked to expose themselves to tremendous harm, and they're also told that they have to be willing to do serious harm to other people. And this is a terribly important step for them to go through. They do it, then they come home, and we say, okay, forget about this subsequent lesson. I'll go back to the original one, and they have to carry alone in their memory. Most people don't understand what they've endured, what it is that they have been through. I've been going down to the military hospital since 2005. I'll be going down again in a week or two. I was down there in late April. I've been 25 to 30 times. And I go bed to bed when I'm there, and I always ask these terribly badly wounded young men and young women what happened to them. And so through that, I have some understanding. I was in the Marines, but I was not in combat. This gives me some understanding of the circumstances that we're asking these young people to face. And, of course, we're doing it multiple times.
Iraq,
unlike other wars, we keep sending them back time and time and time again.
So you've taken the trouble to go down, to go bedside to bedside, and I'm sure you see and hear heart-wrenching stories. But why do you think, Professor Wright, we, meaning everybody, needs to do what you've done and understand better what we're asking them to do, in your own words? Why is that important for, you know, me and the person down the street and the person, you know, listening out there in New Hampshire today?
Because we've asked several thousand of them to get killed, a couple of hundred thousand or more to suffer injuries. And I think when a society does this, we have an obligation to understand what it is that we're asking them to do. We're not most homes in this country are not waiting for the knock on the door. We don't know anybody who's over there. It is a different world. We've talked a lot since the Occupy Wall Street movement about the 99% and their anger with the 1% whom they argue are privileged and protected. There's a reverse of that. 1% of our population is carrying on the wars. 99% of us really have no direct stake in these wars. We're not paying taxes for the wars. We're not sending our sons and daughters off to the war. We have no direct stake in that. And that's different, really, from any previous war in American history.
I want to ask you about that financial disconnect in just a minute, Professor Wright. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. 1-800-892-6477 is the number here in the exchange. Our guest today is former Dartmouth College president and longtime professor of history at Dartmouth, James Wright. His new book is called Those Who Born the Battle, A History of America's Wars and Those Who Fought Them. Join us with your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. If you have a military background, do you feel this disconnect that Professor Wright talks about? How do you think it shapes public policy toward American military intervention? And even if you don't have a military background, how have you seen public attitudes toward wars and those who fight them change over time? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. So let's explore that financial disconnect then between past wars and modern wars. What are you trying to say there, Professor Wright?
I'm saying that really for every war in American history, there's been some sort of a war tax, often a direct tax. Starting with the Civil War, started the income tax in the United States to help pay for the war. And we've had surtaxes. Vietnam, there was a surtax. It came on later with some reluctance then on the part of the Johnson administration, but it was necessary to pay for it. These are the first wars in American history where we've not had any tax to pay for the war. I think that there should be surtaxes on individual and corporate income taxes to help pay for this. Most of us have no stake in the war. As Sam Rayburn, who was a congressional leader from Texas, said in 1950 when Harry Truman asked about a tax to pay for the Korean War, he said, absolutely, we are not going to send these young men off to fight a war, and then when they come home, tell them now you have to help pay for it. We're doing exactly that today. And in 1950, Republican leaders like Richard Nixon and Robert Taft said, absolutely, we have to pay for a war if we're going to war. We don't do that. We've had tax cuts in this war.
So we were blatant about it in the past. We said, hey, folks, we're starting a war, and if you're not sending a son or daughter, you know, cough it up, please. You got to help pay for this.
Yeah, some recent studies have indicated just the 40-year out cost of taking care of the injured from this war is $600 billion to $900 billion.
Wow, just taking care of the
just
injured.
Just taking care of them, and there are estimates that the whole war, all things considered, are about $3 trillion, and. Most of that is being paid for. Most of that is part of our national debt. So these kids will come home and they'll help to retire that debt.
It's interesting. You describe President Johnson as kind of kicking and screaming paying for Vietnam up front. He wanted to do the Great Society at the same time.
He did. He was very reluctant to do this because he thought that it would end up in reductions in some of his domestic programs, and he was very sensitive to the politics of the war. But finally, he came along by 67, 68, and there was a surtax to help pay for the war. It was too late, and it was not adequate. We had major inflation coming out of there, partially as a result of that.
All right. Well, lots more to talk about, Professor Wright, after a short break. And we'll start taking your calls. So if you're on the line, stay there. Our number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And we'll be right back.
This is NHPR. It's 9:19. Good morning, and more of our view of veterans coming up on The Exchange on NHPR. Then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, the pros and cons of long-term care insurance. New Hampshire weather today, cloudy with some showers and thunderstorms. Some storms could be severe, highs in the 70s. Tonight, cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely, lows from 55 degrees in Coos County, ranging to 65 degrees in southern parts of the state. Then tomorrow, sun and clouds, a chance of a shower or thunderstorm, high temperatures in the 70s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the NEEF Network Organizations, a statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college. Information at nhheaf.org. And from R.H. Thaxton & Company, realtors serving the real estate needs of the Monadnock region, New Hampshire, northern Massachusetts, and southeastern Vermont. Information at thaxton.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, former Dartmouth College president James Wright talks about his new book, Those Who Have Borne the Battle, A History of America's Wars and Those Who Fought Them. In it, he talks about how at one time military service was just considered the price of citizenship. Over time, veterans gained in prestige, especially after World War II. Overall, he explores the complicated relationship between our country and our military, a disconnect, he says, that we have today between the broader public and those who fight the wars. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Professor Wright, before we go to the phones, just before the break, we were talking about this financial disconnect that sort of starting with President Johnson in the Vietnam War, he didn't want to raise taxes to pay for the war. It was different, though, 20, 30 years earlier. In 1942, the government commissioned Irving Berlin to write a patriotic song, I Paid My Taxes Today. I find that amazing.
There was, because there was a significant increase in income taxes during World War II. Earlier, most people in the country were not liable for income taxes. It was extended significantly. The tax rate was increased, and it became a patriotic thing to pay your taxes to support the young men who are fighting in the Pacific or in Europe.
Well, and you mentioned also just before the break that the costs of caring for these injured veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan could reach $1 trillion, almost. That's another huge theme in this book, Professor Wright, the question of how those who fight our battles are paid for that work, both during and after. And it's real interesting to see how our attitudes have changed. What about those early years, Professor Wright, the American Revolution, War of 1812, Civil War? How were soldiers paid for or paid back then and taken care of afterwards, if at all?
They were not paid very well
during battle.
During battle, while they were serving, they got out quickly. We depended upon volunteers and we depended upon the militia. The Civil War did have a draft. It was much more extensive, actually, in the Confederate states than it was in the Union states, but we did have a draft during the war. The sense was, and George Washington said during the American Revolution, that all citizens who are part of this democracy have an obligation of their personal treasure to help pay for our wars, and they also have an obligation to serve in the wars. And he suggested every able-bodied man should be a militia member until age 50. Obviously, That was old back then. But there was a sense that. But he also said. He also got very frustrated with the militia because militia were then almost by definition amateur soldiers. They were called up overnight. They could be very effective in defending their home turf or territory, Lexington or Concord or Bunker Hill. But to say, now will you go down to Virginia with us and sit for the campaign over the next 2 years, they would say, no, we've got crops to tend to. We have other things to do. So Washington really depended increasingly on the Continental Army, the regular army, and we have done that during the wars. But we did not provide any support for those who served in the war. It was basically a part of the contract of living in democracy. You have to serve when the republic is threatened. There was a sense if you came out of the war able-bodied, and able-bodied, quite frankly, in the Revolution meant if you had all your limbs, you were able-bodied. They didn't pay much attention to other types of injuries, and they didn't have much money to support them. We provided pensions through the Civil War, through World War I, for veterans after they had served as they got older. But recently as the 20s and 30s, presidents such as Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover were saying, we have no obligation to those who are still healthy. Those healthy citizens who served in the war cannot expect to be paid for it. And Franklin Roosevelt said the same thing when he became president. So it was not simply Republican. It was not simply conservative. It was the viewpoint of the country. Obviously, in 1944, with the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, which we know of as the GI Bill, that changed dramatically.
Huge change.
There was a significant support for all who had served, and not only those who had been injured during the war.
Well, just to give everyone a sense of how dramatically attitudes toward that obligation toward veterans have changed, I just want to read briefly from your book, Professor Wright. Pierre DuPont, whose chemical company had flourished with wartime contracts, said that healthy veterans were, quote, the most favored class in the United States, having health, youth, and opportunity. As far as he was concerned, they did not need a bonus. One Texas congressman said that as long as they had a bonus, black veterans will, quote, not chop cotton or pull corn. The Chamber of Commerce insisted that the country could not afford both the bonus for veterans and a tax cut, and that the latter, meaning the tax cut, was more important. And Secretary of the Treasury Andrew Mellon opposed the bonus due to a pending budget deficit. This has to do with a bonus that World War I veterans felt was owed to them. These attitudes are amazing. No one would say this today.
No one would say this today.
Just remind us real quickly what happened with those World War I veterans, because that was a sea change, too.
There was a bonus bill paid over President Coolidge's veto in 1924. It was to be paid out in 1944. And when the Depression started, the World War I veterans demanded an early payment of their pension, and that ended up with the bonus army, so-called bonus army, going to Washington, protesting there. President Hoover sent General MacArthur and the army and tanks in. They tore down the encampment that the bonus army has had and sent them home. And that was a devastating political move for Hoover to make, that image of the American army sort of knocking down tents of American war veterans was not at all politically palatable to most people.
Yeah, very bad picture on television, if television had been invented. And they brought their families, too, as I understand. They made these giant tent encampments just fighting for their bonuses, and the army came in and swept them out.
It was very ugly. They came back a few years later. Franklin Roosevelt didn't want to pay the bonus either. He arranged quarters for them. They were at a military base, which happened to be several miles from Washington. He sent Mrs. Roosevelt out with donuts and coffee and to talk to them. And so he was more welcoming, but he was no more inclined to pay the bonus early.
Trying to buy him out with donuts and coffee.
Couldn't quite work. Finally, the bonus was paid them over a Roosevelt veto.
All right. Well, let's take some calls. Lots of people want to jump in with you, Professor Wright. Our number here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. As we look at this fascinating history of how we have approached members of our military, how we've paid for the battles that they fight, join us with your comments or questions, especially if you've served in the military or are a member of a military family. What are your thoughts on this topic, and also what Professor Wright calls a disconnect between the broad American public and the small, small slice of those who serve? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And first up is Diane in Bedford. Diane, thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Professor Wright, I'd like to thank you for your topic, for bringing it to the attention of the American people. I think it's one of the most important issues we have today, considering that we send much money and treasure and blood overseas. And the question I have is, you mentioned that when we went to an all-volunteer force, that we would hopefully maintain the size of the service that we need. And my question is, do you think that that is being done effectively now that we have asked our soldiers to return time and again to the battlefront where we've never asked them to do that in the past?
So are there really enough soldiers, Diane, given that people are asked to do multiple deployments with short rest in between? Is that what
exactly
you're trying to say? Yeah.
No.
Thanks,
and
Diane.
Then another.
Oh, sorry, Diane. Go ahead, Professor Wright.
Diane, it is the case that the military, the Army infantry, the paratroop divisions, and the Marine Corps have not been large enough for the scale of this war. Nobody anticipated at the outset how long it would take. Nobody anticipated the nature of the war. Nobody anticipated the sorts of casualties that we would have there. And so we have deployed and redeployed and redeployed, and that means that we're fighting a war. I don't know if it's on the cheap, but certainly it's we're not asking more people to serve during this war. When we went to the all-volunteer force in 1973, there was a sense that we would have to call up National Guard and reserve units, which we've done for this war far more than anyone had anticipated. And there was a presumption that this would act as sort of a tripwire in a democracy. If we're calling up these units, then it will become politically more complicated to justify a war. And I think the military and everyone coming out of Vietnam wanted to make certain that there was public buy-in for the war. The early evidence would indicate that the calling up Guard and Reserve units has not had this sort of tripwire impact during the current wars.
Now, that's real interesting. Can you go back on that, Professor Wright, please? So this idea that the thinking was, okay, if we have to reach into the National Guard in all 50 states, that will put the brakes on the move to another war? Is that what you're saying there?
I think it would cause people to think very carefully about war and about the duration of war.
Because it's more of a connection with the community?
Because there's more of a connection with community. But again, I think that some of the research would indicate that that's not had an impact. And the research would suggest that these communities are not necessarily asking harder questions about the war. They're not becoming more hostile to the war, more negative than the population as a whole.
So why is that?
It's a good question. I think part of it is when we know somebody, when somebody from our family is in the war, it's very hard to say we don't believe in this war. And I think that support comes more naturally, but I think when you've got multiple deployments, it slows down. I've talked to many people who are in military families. When I go to the hospitals and visit with the injured servicemen and women there, their families are often with them, and I talk to the families as well. And they've incurred a significant burden during these wars.
Diane, thanks a lot for that call. And let's go to Bob in Springfield next. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. My experience, first of all, is that I volunteered to go in the military after graduating from college in 1966. I trained as an infantry officer, and I was never deployed in Vietnam. But I'm very aware of, you know, the training and what goes on and what happens in the field. When I came out of the military, although I loved the military, what I noticed was that a lot of people who hadn't gone in had pursued a master's degree and so forth. So although I had a good position when I started, a lot of the people that had gone on for master's degrees or PhDs were further ahead in the career track. Now, for a young person right out of high school going to college or going to the military, they are going to get an Army education, whatever that happens to be in their MOS, but that's not directly transferable to a civilian job when they get out.
Wow, Bob, so it's hard to get a job. You're kind of behind, you're saying, when
that's
you get
right,
out.
That's right, because, you know, it's just totally different. The learning you get is totally different. And as one of my platoon sergeants told me, there's not that many jobs for riflemen in the civilian world.
So how did you end up, Bob, real quickly? Did you end up finding a decent job, or are you still struggling?
Yeah. I was well-trained. I already had a degree. But
sure.
What I'm getting at is that for young people today, to go in and they believe in what they're being told. I mean, they're young, and they are naive, and they're patriotic. And you change through time because you become more world-wise. But when you come out of the military and you've been in there for 4 years, let's say a young person, and hopefully they haven't been wounded or injured or had, you know, other issues, now they've got to start they have to get back into the civilian world where the standards are different, where they have to go to college or get training school,
right,
and so forth. And then civilian people in industry, people are looking at the bottom line. They're looking at what you can do for them.
Right.
Yes, it's nice that you were in the military, but how are you going to apply what you know, and how are you going to transfer that to a job that's
right. How are you
going to
help my company prosper? You know, this is a great point. Bob, thank you so much for calling in. What do you think, Professor Wright?
Well, there's no doubt that it's embarrassing that the unemployment among veterans, young veterans of these wars, is much higher than their age group today. Obviously, unemployment is a problem for all Americans, for many Americans, I should say, today, but it's even more acute on the part of veterans. And I think that Bob is right. There is some concern about training. I keep telling, when I speak to the veterans, I encourage them to continue with their education. And I tell them they've already demonstrated a tremendous sense of discipline, an ability to work within a group, a tremendous amount of intelligence, ability to learn how to use complicated systems and complicated pieces of equipment. They should move ahead and do anything they want to do. I think that all of the conversations about PTSD, all of the concerns about multiple deployment in combat may well cause some employers to say, boy, I really support veterans, but I'm not sure that this person would be the right influence in my shop.
Really?
In
like
my
he
program.
Might be emotionally unstable.
Yeah,
wow.
I think there is some of that going on. And it's not explicit, but certainly if you talk to veterans, if you talk to others, there's a concern about that.
I'm stunned by that. So for all the, you know, hurrah for our sons and daughters who fight our wars, and thank you so much, and happy Memorial Day, I don't want to hire you.
Well, I quote somebody in the book who said it's far easier to cheer somebody else's kid than to send your own kid to fight the war. And that sounds very cynical, and I really do believe that there is a tremendous and genuine warmth and support toward veterans today. That is not cynical. It's not manipulative. It's terribly powerful. But you still don't know the experience yourself.
Our number here in the exchange again is 1-800-892-6477. Thanks, Bob, for that call. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Also, the exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you'll go to our page, join the conversation there. And Professor Wright, up next is Oliver in Concord. Hi, Oliver. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Wonderful show. Dr. Wright, thank you very much for this discussion. I think you, as well as the previous caller, hit at a point that I have found incredibly true. I served 24 years in the Marine Corps, made 9 combat deployments, Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places. And what is very difficult for veterans these days, and that is to translate their military resume. If you've been a platoon sergeant, you've been a squad leader, you've been a section leader, to translate that to a civilian workplace who does not have military experience and understanding, that becomes a challenge. And I've worked with a lot of local employers here in Concord and around to do that. They'll call me up and say, can you translate that? And I can tell them straight up, I'm telling you, this guy is going to be able to do what you ask him to do tenfold. That right there, and then I would ask your comments on that, how we can make that do a better job to translate military experience into the workplace.
Oliver, thanks a lot for calling in, and thanks for your service in Afghanistan and Iraq. Go ahead, Professor Wright.
Yes, Oliver, Semper Fi. I think that we need to do a better job. The pre-discharge orientation sessions are brief, they're hurried, and they're general. I think we have to work on more individual counseling of people who are leaving the military and enable them to sell themselves. It's great when there's somebody like you around that can help interpret experiences to employers. I wish more employers would bring in you and others for that sort of assistance. But let's face it, that's not likely to happen across the board. People have to sell themselves, and I think that these young servicemen and women are often ironically shy about doing that. They're certainly not shy when they're in combat zones, but they're shy about doing that, and I do think stronger counseling. My focus, my work has been primarily in the military hospitals and encouraging people to continue their education. And I just keep telling them they can do anything they want to do. They have to work at it, and we can find people to help them. And I think they're demonstrating that. We'll have a couple of more veterans graduate from Dartmouth in a week. We've had several over the last few years, and I'm delighted to know them and to know that they're coming here. University of New Hampshire has done well. Bunker Hill Community College in Charleston just is a model at bringing in veterans and empowering them. It takes more than just bringing these guys in. You have to be able to work with them and enable them, first encourage them to expand their own aspirations, then enable them to meet those expanded aspirations.
Well, in New England College, from what I understand, and Henniker has also done a ton with veterans. Oliver, thanks again for that call. We'll take more of your calls after a short break, so stay on the line or join us now at 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
Today on Word of Mouth, going gaga for baby gizmos. Electronic folding strollers, HD video monitors, digital bathtubs, and hundreds of apps have changed the nature of bringing up baby. A new parent and seasoned automotive reviewer turns her expertise to the high-octane market of baby gadgetry. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth welcomes the birth of bouncing new ideas today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from AARP, presenting You've Earned a Say, a community discussion on Medicare and Social Security, inviting Granite Staters to join the conversation. Details at aarp.org/NH. And Dr. Cameron Iles of Sports Medicine Atlantic Orthopedics of Portsmouth, providing comprehensive treatment for foot and ankle issues, surgery, and reconstruction. SMAO.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a look at the national debate over state control of liquor sales. Email us your thoughts on this before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today on The Exchange, James Wright is with us, former Dartmouth College president, longtime professor of history at Dartmouth. He's written a new book. It's called Those Who Have Borne the Battle, A History of America's Wars and Those Who Fought Them. Join us if you've served in the military or are a member of a military family. Do you feel this disconnect that Professor Wright talks about between those who serve and those who don't? How do you see this gap shaping our public policy toward military intervention or just the attitudes of your own neighbors? Even if you don't have military experience, over time, how have you seen public attitudes toward the wars and those who fight them change? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Professor Wright, there's another trend in your book that you cover over time that we haven't talked about yet, It's what you call increasing civilian deference to military leaders when it comes to making decisions about war. What's been the traditional view of this relationship between elected political leaders and the military members who are supposed to report to them?
Yeah, the revolutionary generation was very concerned about the military having too much influence in a democracy. And so they made very clear, and George Washington assisted with this, that the military would always be accountable to a civilian leadership, and civilians would make the determination as to where the military would be engaged. And we followed that through our history, and we followed it until today, including today. It's certainly the civilian leadership that makes these basic determinations of war or no war. I am concerned when you hear members of Congress saying, well, we can't really decide that until we see what it is the generals think about it. And I've met a number of generals. I have a tremendous regard for them. They're dedicated. They're patriotic. They are very professional. But they don't set our policies. It should be set in the Congress. And we should not be saying, let's see what the generals have to say about this. We should listen to the generals, and they should lay out the practical considerations, the practical problems, if we take a particular policy direction or agree to do something. And my concern, you mentioned early on my note about fewer and fewer veterans serving in Congress, and ironically my concern with that is not that they become hostile to the military. If anything, people who have not served are more likely to say, yes, we can't challenge the military, where an old Marine Lance Corporal like me would be more likely to take some pleasure even in asking somebody with a lot of braid on their hat some tough questions about what it is that they're doing. So I do worry about people. There is a real political fear about crossing the military. And, in a democracy such as ours, there has to be a willingness to ask hard questions, to say no. And I think we have to continue to work on that.
So, and you gave the numbers early on, or I did, 20% of Congress today has military experience compared to 50% just in 1990, not that long ago. So you're saying this lack of military creds, if I could put it that way, makes members of Congress timid and they say yes, sir, whatever you say.
I think that's a danger. It truly is. And if you look at our last presidential elections, military heroes, military veterans, George Bush Sr., Bob Dole, Al Gore, who had served in Vietnam, John Kerry, who had served in Vietnam and came back with medals, John McCain, a true hero. These gentlemen all lost the election. It's not that there's an anti-military bias in the country. I don't think that at all. But clearly having served in the military is no longer itself proof that you should be elected.
Well, you could argue, Professor Wright, that, look, the military brass are the people who have studied the history of war. They've studied strategy. They look at the numbers. They talk to people on the ground. I mean, they're kind of the experts. So why not ask them about the best way to proceed?
We should ask them the best way to proceed. We have to set the goals that we're proceeding toward. And that's my only point. But absolutely. Military tactics, size and scale of operations. So we need to get the advice from the military on this. And we need to learn to follow that advice at the appropriate time. When we started the war in Iraq, there was a sense that we could do it with shock and awe and not a lot of groups on the ground, boots on the ground. The military really pushed back against that. They did it quietly, as they should. I think General Shinseki, General Shinseki, I believe, was one of the few people who spoke out who was still on active duty. But they did not publicly challenge, and they shouldn't publicly challenge. But we ignored them then, and we shouldn't have ignored them. They knew it would take more troops on the ground in Iraq.
Our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And waiting in Hanover is Phil. Hi, Phil. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks a lot, and thank you, Dr. Wright. I come from the Vietnam era and was not a member of the military and was not a member of a military family. In fact, the last member of the family who may have been in the military was in the Civil War. But amongst the people, my peers, very few people were interested in fighting in the Vietnam War. Those who did, I think one of the many people I knew, only one volunteered. The rest were terrified of being drafted. They didn't believe in the war, basically. And I think that things changed right after the Vietnam War because there was such a movement to resist that war that politicians wanted to do away with that in the future. And so this is one of the, whether intended or unintended, consequences of a shift of policy that results in disconnect between the military, those who serve in the military, and the rest of the public. And also exacerbates deference to politicians and military leaders, just so as not to have the government be accountable to the ventures that it participates in, because there's less, excuse the expression, skin in the game for most people in the society.
So you're talking about the lack of a draft, Phil, there, right?
Draft is one thing. What I'm also concerned about are the moral implications of fewer and fewer people because of a movement toward drones, combat robots, and private military, if you want to call it, mercenary forces like Blackwater or whatever. That moves that drift even further from connectedness and engagement and support of those who have served in the military.
Phil, good points. Thank you so much. And boy, that's an extension of what you're talking about.
It is. Thank you, Phil. I have a chapter in my book, the chapter following one that discusses the Vietnam War, called History Lessons, and it really has to do with the various lessons that people read from and continue to read from the Vietnam War. And the real tragedy of this is that they don't agree on the lessons of that war. Everyone can read from it the lessons that they want as a way to justify supporting a policy or opposing a policy, and that's too bad. Vietnam, those who fought there deserve better than to always be a negative reference point for everything, as negative in many ways as the decision was to go to this war. I do think that people don't have skin in the game, as Laura said, Phil, and part of this has to do with the draft when just such a small percentage are serving. I'm not optimistic that wars in the future will be fought by drones. After World War II, we thought it would be all air power. There's even some consideration about discontinuing the Marine Corps and having the Army just be a support and guard unit for the Air Force, because air power would take care of it. We learned differently in Korea and Vietnam. We're learning that now. Drones are very effective, but drones are basically high-tech, effective assassination devices. I don't see anything replacing having kids over there, as we say, with boots on the ground. And we can't learn the wrong lessons from these wars either.
Well, wrong being a matter of opinion, right? As you said,
yes.
People are drawing different lessons
from this.
That's part of the trouble.
You know, we talked about the Munich lesson after World War II, and the Munich lesson was, you know, basically like a schoolyard bully. You have to stand up to the bully. We didn't stand up to Hitler. And, you know, there's some truth to that. It was not applied evenly, but at least everybody understood what the Munich lesson was. I'm not sure if they understand what the lessons of Vietnam have been, and I'm not confident that they will understand what lessons we should really take from our current wars. They have been sustained wars. The mission has changed. We're engaged in negotiation. We're using military forces as basically civil units to help people, help protect, using as police forces, using them as agricultural agents, as civic affairs officers. And these young men and women are doing a remarkable job of it. But is that the proper use of the American military?
you know, one history lesson, if I could put it that way, from that you might think that you would come out in favor of, Professor Wright, is given your concern that wars, pain, and sacrifice is not shared across the population, you know, you'd think that you would end the book by saying, and I, James Wright, favor a draft. Again, let's bring it back. It's the only fair way to do it. But you don't. How come?
Yeah, I find a certain intellectual attractiveness in a draft because it could make for a more representative military force. There's no doubt. In 2010 there were nearly 4.4 million 18-year-olds in the United States. In that year, the military accessioned, as DOD calls it, 160,000 young American men and women. They joined the Army, one of the armed forces, both as officers and enlisted men and women. This was about less than 4% of the 18-year-olds. And so my question is, if this is the size of the military, and it's going to get even smaller, presumably in the next few years, what less than 4% will serve? And I know the military forces would just soon have those who want to be there rather than somebody who's dragged kicking and screaming from his or her first year in college, and now they have to be in the military. And so I think that we're better off probably letting those who want to serve. We need to do a better job of recognizing them. We need to do a better job of realizing what it is that we're asking them to do. War, in many ways, is as cruel as it is also a very human experience. We need to humanize it. We need to understand the faces of these casualties, of those kids who are serving, and what it is that they're enduring. And they're enduring a tremendous amount of pressure. They're going through some very difficult situations. And finally, we need to pay for wars ourselves. I argue and insist that it's time for us, if we're going to fight wars, to pay for it up front rather than to do it on debt. Most Americans in this political year are not going to want to talk about taxes, but I'm convinced that many people who are anti-tax would say, yeah, maybe I should pay a surtax to help pay for this war. And if they don't say that, they should say it.
So when the president comes on television and says, my fellow Americans, we're going to war against country X because of X, and you're all going to have to pay 5% more because of it.
I think the one should follow the other, because these things cost a lot of money. They cost a lot of blood. They cost a lot of treasure. They disrupt and sometimes destroy a lot of lives. And the least we can do is help to pay for it.
How did those severely wounded, in some cases, young men and women that you visited in the hospitals over the last, gosh, 5, 6, 7 years, Professor Wright, how do they shape this book? How are their stories reflected in this book?
Well, I always ask them what happened to them, but I haven't taken notes because I'm not there doing research. But I remember some of the conversations. They helped shape the book because I have put a face now on the human side of this war, and I'm just frustrated that more people don't understand what it is that we're asking them to do and provide greater support and encouragement for them when they come home. It's fine to applaud them at the beginning of a ball game like rock stars, but as rock stars learn, finally the music stops. The last World War I veteran died in the last year. Based on that projection, the last veterans of these wars will probably die in 2105. They deserve better than to be wards of the state. We have to look out for them and recognize the tremendous potential they have. We have to empower them, and that's a theme of this book as far as I'm concerned.
Support beyond cheering at a baseball game.
Absolutely.
Meaning the jobs that we talked about earlier, maybe helping them pursue higher education as you have been trying to do.
Absolutely. I think that.
What's the goal of this, Professor Wright, of this book overall, especially for those of us who are not connected to the military in a big way? What do you hope non-military people take away from it? I think military folks will read this and go, wow, this is so interesting to see how our attitudes have changed over time. But what about those among us who don't have any connection?
Yeah, I'm an old history teacher, and I did not intend to write this book. We were talking earlier, Laura, when 3 years ago, when I stepped down as president, people said, are you going to write a book? I said, no, this book came at me when I realized there was not such a book out there, and somebody said, write it yourself and quit complaining, and so I've done that. As an old history teacher, I really want Americans to understand better the history of the way this country has looked after veterans, the history of the way we have mobilized for war, how it's different today, and our responsibility to put our arms around these differences, to appreciate them more fully, and to be willing to help pay for our wars.
There's been a lot of talk after Memorial Day about how it's become a barbecue kickoff to the summer and nobody goes to the parades and, you know, nobody takes the time to put flowers on a grave and so forth. How did you spend Veterans Day, Professor Wright?
Well, we drove back from Maine, but we stopped to see part of the Kennebunk.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot here.
No,
but
fair enough. The Kennebunk parade yesterday morning. We're coming back from Maine And I spent it thinking about and reading about and thinking about these things. I did not go to a parade. And you know, Americans should have their cookouts. It's the start of summer. They should have their picnics. They should go to ball games. These kids have fought in these wars and all the wars in our history to enable us to have those sorts of choices about how we're spending our time. But just stop for a minute and think about what it is that we're asking them to do. Stop and think about memorials for our family members, not simply veterans, our family and friends, the loved ones that we lost. That's what Memorial Day is about. But it also is increasingly about those who have fought in the wars. And we can all stop for a little bit and reflect on this. So I wrote the book to find the biggest lectern, history teaching lectern I could find to talk about these issues. And that's why I'm delighted to be here with you again and be able to talk on this subject and talk to the people who've called in.
Have you sent copies to those you've visited in the hospitals?
No, I'm going down to Bethesda Hospital in a couple of weeks, and I and some others are supplying books to give to all of them. I'm going to talk about the experience there. But I have supplied books to a few of them. But no, I've seen 300 to 400 young men and women over the last, and I don't know their names because I've not taken notes, as I said. I respect their privacy, so I couldn't do that. But we are going to give some books away in a couple of weeks.
Well, it's great to see you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Professor James Wright, former Dartmouth College president, and his new book is called Those Who Have Borne the Battle. Professor Wright, we're going to close out with that song that you mentioned earlier, Irving Berlin's I Paid My Income Tax Today, again, urging people in the 1940s to help fund the war. Here it is, sung by Danny Kaye.
I paid my income tax today. 1,000 planes to bomb Berlin, they'll all be paid for and I chipped in. That certainly makes me feel okay. 10,000 more and that ain't hay. We must pay for this war somehow. Uncle Sam was worried, but he isn't now. I paid my income tax today.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Alan Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music is usually composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. Our intern is Ryan Lessard. And I'm Laura Canoy.
Lower brackets, that's my speed, but he was glad to see me. I paid my income tax today. I never felt so proud before to be right there with the millions more who pay their income tax today.